I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to be talking about North Korea, how the country has learned to survive through years of targeted sanctions, how developed their nuclear weapons program is, what U.S. policy has been and what it is now, and what role is China playing in allowing North Korea to build a pretty sophisticated nuclear arsenal. The show today comes on news reported today from CNN that U.S. intelligence agencies indicate that North Korea is making preparations for another intercontinental ballistic missile or an intermediate-range missile test. Two administration officials familiar with the latest intelligence confirm there are indications of test preparations that could lead to a potential launch in about 2 weeks. We have two guests with us for the course of this hour. Melissa Hannum is a senior research associate in the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey's East Asian Nonproliferation Program. She studies nuclear proliferation in North Korea, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, China's nuclear posture, and East Asian security. Melissa, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Our pleasure. John Park is also here. John is director of the Korea Working Group and an adjunct lecturer at Harvard Kennedy School. He's a faculty affiliate with the Project on Managing the Atom at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have both of you to talk about this country that's been a problem for us for a long time. But now these missiles, can both of you respond to this news from CNN that intelligence officials are saying that maybe within the next 2 weeks there may be another intercontinental ballistic missile test? Melissa, you want to start?
Sure. One of the things that's available to many intelligence agencies and also the public more and more is satellite imagery. And so one of the things that different intelligence agencies are doing are constantly scanning satellite imagery of different locations that are good launching spots for missiles. Increasingly, the public can be involved in this process too. The cost of satellite imagery has really gone down with the rise of small satellites. So companies like Planet put out these small satellites that collect medium-resolution image, and they sell it relatively cheap, at least cheap enough that civil society organizations like mine or Harvard, for example, can purchase these images and analyze them. So probably what people are seeing are launch preparations, and this would include the movement of large trucks around some of the warehouses where we've seen these ICBMs before. These would include, like, fueling trucks, large trucks that carry the missiles, and then they would be setting up a location from which to launch.
And John, they just launched one of these on July 4. These are not inexpensive things to be launching. Where are they getting the money?
That's a great question in the sense that we've been trying to track that. The North Korean regime over the years has developed different types of revenue streams, but the most lucrative has been the coal trade. We've heard a lot about current efforts by the Chinese authorities to do what's called sectoral bans under UN Security Council resolutions. But really, I think if you look at it, the big pot of money that the North Koreans made and from which they're deriving, I think, a lot of the financing for further development of their ballistic and nuclear weapons program, it's from the coal trade in the late 2000s. This was a period, Kathleen, where the global commodity price for coal was at all-time highs. It was about $100 per ton. And so you could see how that was a very lucrative time period for the North Korean regime.
Mm-hmm. You also have done a lot of studying of China's influence now, the relationship. I think you called it North Korea Inc. and China Inc.
That's correct. And this is a very, specialized type of program in the sense that certainly the earlier portions of North Korea's nuclear weapons development program was through essentially a military-industrial complex. But now a lot of the procurement that's happening, if you will, the top half of these ballistic missiles, where it's circuitry and electronics and other things, these things are being procured in marketplaces, and a lot of these marketplaces are in China. The vehicle on the North Korean side is what my colleague Dr. Jim Walsh at MIT and I called North Korea Incorporated, which is the collection of these elite state trading companies interacting with Chinese companies, and again, through the marketplace, procuring some of these items.
Mm-hmm. So could some kind of sanctions on countries, and I guess you'd need a willingness, Melissa, for countries to adhere to this. Shouldn't there be some kind of sanctions on exporting these pieces for missiles to the North Koreans?
Yes, indeed. There are both bilateral sanctions that the U.S. imposes as well as U.N. Security Council sanctions in place. And the trick, as you sort of noted, is as actually enforcing these sanctions. And China, you know, is in a somewhat of a tough position. If you think of the amount of trade they actually conduct, just the sheer volume of that is difficult to regulate. In addition, China's goals for North Korea are a little bit different than the U.S.'s, for example. They're much more nervous about a collapsed North Korea. And perhaps the U.S. should take note of this, too. So China does engage in some trade, which it deems legal, in order to keep North Korea going. And it's not happy with the way North Korea has been procuring items through its Chinese marketplaces and even smuggling them across the border. But it's sort of in a tough position because they feel that if they push sanctions too hard, especially things on sort of basic staples, that they might precipitate a kind of collapse that would cause refugees to flow into China. So the challenge here is threading that fine needle there. China, you know, has announced that it was going to include coal as, close the loophole on coal. But it's pretty hard for us to tell on the outside with open source tools whether they're actually enforcing that or not. Typically what we do is look at trade data as well, again, as satellite images of coal shipments. And there's not a lot of data available yet, but it kind of looks like China is maybe not strictly enforcing this.
And, John, what about the possible collapse of the North Korean regime? I have read, and it continues to be the case, that people are rather poor. They don't know what's going on in the outside world. So maybe if you don't know, that's your plight and you're okay with it. That's life. But what about the regime itself? Is there an imminent threat of it collapsing? Could it collapse?
There's always that possibility. I think if you look at it from the Chinese government think tank analyst lens, they're always worried about some sort of factional fighting within the North Korean regime. But one point that is important as a foundational piece when you're looking at the different activities of the groups in North Korea, you're really looking at the story of the 99% and the 1%. The 99% are those through their own means have been able to carve out livelihood through these informal markets and basically have been very entrepreneurial and resourceful. The 1%, and that's broadly the population of the North Korean regime, they have globalized. You're looking at a lot of members of the 1% who travel or live in commercial hubs in China and Southeast Asia.
Really?
Yeah, you were talking about the elites within this 1%. And so it debunks a lot of myths. And again, I think you can only really see this if you don't treat North Korea as a country and do the standard, you know, per capita analysis that a lot of government agencies do in comparing North Korea to other countries. But if you do zero in on that 1%, you could actually see signs of conspicuous consumption and luxury items and prosperity in Pyongyang that, frankly, we haven't seen before. And so it raises these inconvenient questions of, you know, how effective really are sanctions as they're geared towards the banned luxury items. One thing that we found with the operation of North Korea Incorporated, you're looking at pretty sophisticated business operations. And I think that's the operative word. These are market-oriented firms. And as they operate in that sector and in that marketplace in China, it is a huge positive unintended consequence of being a neighbor to the world's fastest-growing economy when you look at this massive movement into this middle class and a large growing Chinese national economy.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, what would cause the collapse of the regime?
I don't think anyone knows for sure. There's a lot of speculation about whether the death of Kim Jong-un could precipitate it or not. It's been a dynastic situation. So, Kim Il-sung was very clear about who his heir was, and that was Kim Jong-un's father. You know, it was not clear immediately who Kim Jong-il's successor would be, and Kim Jong-un himself has not officially revealed an heir yet. It's not surprising to not do that immediately because it's almost like Game of Thrones. They're a little bit concerned about the safety of future heirs. But if, for example, Kim Jong-un were to slip on a banana peel, it's not clear who would fill the power vacuum. And this is in part why, you know, there's so much speculation about factions within North Korea and why there is so much concern about what happens if something that drastic were to come about. So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's not clear that that would precipitate the fall of the state, but it's also not clear, you know, given that Kim Jong-un is regarded almost as a god, that those elites, if they could not hold on to their power or felt unsafe, they wouldn't just start walking towards the nearest border.
John, North Korea, it has been said, sees weapons as its only hope for survival. If they lose them, they risk provoking the country's fears of a full invasion or an effort to topple the government. Is it the only hope for survival? Is that the main reason for all these ballistic tests and building of these weapons?
I mean, that's the stated purpose, but to widen the aperture, that is one pillar within a policy. You know, the North Korean regime has a game plan, and Kim Jong-un has been very explicit about what he calls Pyongjin, which means a parallel development of a nuclear weapons deterrent for defense purposes, and then the second piece of increasing the prosperity of the economy. But for the nuclear weapons piece, that is seen as the answer to the hostile policy that they have been long crediting being the source of how the United States has been threatening the existence and survival of the North Korean regime. So this fits into their game plan, and I think for a few years now that game plan has been seen as somewhat far-fetched, but every successive test that Kim Jong-un does as he reaches these different thresholds, you're kind of seeing the fruition of this game plan. The economic development side is going to take longer, but it's almost the notion of, as you see the North Korean regimes, as according to what they've been stating on a regular basis, they secure their defenses, demobilize this massive military, and relocate assets to the development of its economy. Some see it as a pipe dream. Others see it as a pretty methodical you know, set of steps that the North Koreans have been making a pretty significant forward movement on.
We seem to be, Melissa and John, I want both of you to respond to this, too, at an impasse here. With the successful launch of some of these missiles and the fact that it could reach Anchorage, Alaska now, the United States doesn't seem to be able to know what to do. Sanctions really haven't worked. Can we have some kind of deterrent like we did with the Russians during the Cold War, but that doesn't seem to be a possibility. I mean, where do we go from here to ease the possibility of a nuclear confrontation? It would be awful.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're facing a lot of bad options, and that's the problem. And for decades, administration after administration has been kicking the can down the line. Unfortunately, by sort of having inaction, we have given North Korea time to build up their weapons capabilities. And their weapons capabilities now are such that they've crossed this red line that Donald Trump certainly didn't want to have, no Americans wanted. And now we are in, you know, probably one of the worst negotiating positions we've ever been in. No one who's taken seriously wants to simply topple the regime in a military interaction. But, you know, at the same time, no one wants to negotiate with a historical bad actor with terrible human rights abuses. So, you know, it's been sort of, you know, just passed down by administration by administration. Now that they've tested an ICBM and they've tested it to the range of Alaska, but and I think we may even see in the next missile test, the range is probably farther. We don't, you know, at least based on the calculations that we're doing here at Middlebury, the missile was not tested to its full capability. We're in a position where North Korea is going to try to be a wedge and split the alliance between South Korea and the U.S. They are very aware that, on the one hand, their entire regime, their entire livelihood and existence rests on the defensiveness of these weapons, and that the U.S. is perhaps not as committed to removing them from existence than they are in staying in.
Mm-hmm.
So one missile, is certainly not a thing that will, end the U.S.'s commitment to South Korea, but that's the line that North Korea is pushing, that, would you be willing to trade San Diego for Seoul, something like that. I don't want to alarm people too much. What I'm trying to say is it is time to act now. We've waited too long, and we've underestimated their weapons capabilities for too long, and doing nothing simply gives them more time, and with more time, they will keep testing larger warheads, more powerful ICBMs. And so instead, we have to, unfortunately, face the really bad option of negotiating with them. And they may cheat, and so it'll be a very tough negotiation. I think it'll be a great deal tougher than the Iran deal, for example. But we have to take this time, because it's already, many, many years past where we really should have engaged.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we should negotiate, John?
I think the negotiation piece of it is always an important element in trying to deal with the North Korean regime, but I think consensus view among a lot of the North Korea watchers is that the North Korean program is very far advanced now. If it were at an earlier stage, there may be more enticements, more basis of negotiation. And negotiations, this is something that the word means different things to different groups in the sense of what the objectives or the framing of that would be. From the North Korean perspective, they actually are interested in negotiations, but it's not denuclearization. If you piece it together, what they want is a nuclear arms control type of negotiation where they are able to retain a minimal nuclear deterrent. So this is a small number of nuclear weapons that they can use just for self-defense, be recognized as a nuclear weapon state, and then essentially be in the midst of opportunities for peaceful coexistence, economic development, all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a setting of a table that very few will come to. Some would probably say no one will come to. But that is also a distinct possibility in the sense that out of the options that Melissa mentioned, one of that is the notion that we may have no other choice is, again, the consensus view for many that one of the very viable options is trying to live with a nuclear North Korea and what that all means. Having said that, there is also, I think, an important element of those within government, which the view is using all the tools available to the U.S. Government to try to shape the decision point for the North Korean regime in the sense of getting the North Korean regime to realize that it is a bleaker future. It becomes more difficult through the different application of these policy tools. And eventually get Kim Jong-un to arrive at a decision that is more aligned with maybe not immediately denuclearization, but at least a freeze in getting onto a path that would be a negotiated settlement. So we're kind of dealing with two sets of constructed realities in what could potentially happen. But I think the commonality between these two constructed realities is the fact that North Korea is very far advanced with their nuclear weapons program.
Let's go to some phone calls. John, I know you're only with us for the till the halfway point of this hour, so let's get some calls for both our guests. Melissa will be here the full hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. Melissa has to leave at the half hour, and John will be with us the full hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are starting our calls with Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hey. Okay. I am very curious about, I don't know, was it a year ago? There was some North Korean official murdered in an airport, I think, in Southeast Asia by a couple of you know, like hired assassins who put poison on him. And that just made me really, really curious. Does the U.S. intelligence, does anyone know who those people were working for? Like, was it an effort to, within the regime, like an interfactional struggle to seize power, or was it like revolutionary?
What do we know? Melissa, can you give an answer?
Sure. So the gentleman you mentioned was named Kim Jong-nam, and he is Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea's older half-brother. And many of us thought that he would take power after Kim Jong-il died. Instead, the youngest brother took power. He sort of lived this strange life in Hong Kong, and he's traveled, and he's sort of had this kind of wealthy existence. But, you know, his mysterious death in an airport has, you know, raised a lot of eyebrows. You know, the most surprising thing about this was that a VX nerve agent was used. So two different women approached him and wiped his face with two different chemical reagents, which combined to create this VX nerve agent. And then he died soon afterwards. I think there's no official proof that I know of in open source that this was done by North Korea, but I think the sort of belief, the consensus belief, is that North Korean agents sort of tricked or coerced these women into doing this activity. There are some rumors that they thought they were in a game show or something like that. North Korea worked hard to get the body afterwards, and eventually Kim Jong-nam's son, I think, did release the body back to North Korea. It's a sad story, but it's also, you know, a story that is not unknown in the Kim family. Jang Son-taek, who's Kim Jong-un's uncle, I should say, was also executed, and in a way it's a consolidation of power. So it's, you know, it's possible that Kim Jong-nam was seen as a threat to the leadership of North Korea, that perhaps he was talking too much, particularly to Japanese journalists, and so he was murdered.
Hmm. Melissa, thank you for your contribution to this program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. John is staying with us. Melissa Hannum, we thank. Senior Research Associate in the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey's East Asian Nonproliferation Program. John Park is with us for the full hour. We'll continue our conversation and take phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I want John to respond to what Bill Richardson, who was sometimes a mediator between the U.S. and North Korea, had to say in terms of how optimistic he was figuring out a solution to this impasse and to the nuclear threat that North Korea now poses. He was asked to rate his optimism on a scale of 1 to 10, and he said, "I'm at about a 3 right now, and it's dwindling. I'm worried. I am really worried." 800-486-8655, the number. This is the Ideas Network. Staying with us this hour, John Park, director of the Korea Working Group and adjunct lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School. The North Koreans, according to News Today, are about to test another, it could be an intercontinental ballistic missile, and that could happen sometime in the next 2 weeks. So what are we to do about all of this? I wanted you to respond to Bill Richardson's concerns. He's worried. He's very worried. He really doesn't see an end to all of this. Do you share that concern, John?
Well, there is a very big concern that I share, and that is uncharted territory to actually have North Korea making this type of progress towards, first, intercontinental ballistic missile that can range now Alaska, and we'll see how much farther it can go after the next upcoming test, be that in 2 weeks or beyond. And then the possibility that North Korea would put a nuclear warhead on that particular delivery system, that is going to be a direct threat to the American homeland. And that is an elevation of North Korea as a threat that we haven't seen before. So to echo what Governor Richardson was saying, the concerns are very high, because that doesn't make military action by the United States a certainty, but it does raise the likelihood. So this is a probability aspect, and we haven't seen that likelihood this high before.
Hmm. If it is one of the goals of the regime to have the world accept their nuclear state status, is that really a non-starter? They also want significant rollbacks to our conventional, the U.S. conventional military presence in the Asian theater. Are those non-starters for the U.S.?
Certainly from a standpoint of optics and policy positions, it makes it very difficult. But I think the crux of the issue is the fact that you would have a country of North Korea's background and track record, essentially, you know, a small country that has had a history from the U.S. perspective of breaking agreements and engaging a lot of very problematic activities, having what is the ultimate weapon in international society, which is a nuclear ICBM. To have a country like China or Russia with that capability, there's a certain sense there these countries are peers to the United States and that their understandings about countries at this kind of stature. But for North Korea, a smaller country, to have this capability, that's the part that it really doesn't figure into calculations and policies and positions that we've had in the past. This truly is uncharted territory.
It seems, John, as though this development has been relatively rapid. It seems like it wasn't that many years ago that they were doing some tests and they fizzled.
That's right. And the fizzling part, the technical experts would say that that's a big part of the learning curve, that a country that is going to develop the nuclear component and the ballistic missile component, especially ones that go farther and farther in terms of range, will have failures in the beginning. But it's how countries that are doing this kind of development learn from those failures and move forward. And if you look at North Korean regime's progress in this, there has been a net forward movement, and that's the part that is very troubling. When it comes to this notion of how are they doing this, this goes back to this procurement, the ability to procure the items that have more of the high-tech caliber, things that would not necessarily be produced within North Korea. But seemingly the North Koreans are it's not a challenge for them to procure these items.
Mm-hmm. And let's go back to that conversation for a moment. Is there anything in the world that can be done? Does the United States need to put more pressure on China? Are these parts coming from other parts of the world where we need to negotiate, or the UN needs to step in here more forcefully?
Sure. You know, back not too far ago, the North Korean regime did their procurement, essentially sending their procurement agents to Eastern Europe or the Middle East, and they wanted the equivalent of business trips. They would go over, procure the item, and then come back home. But in doing that, they didn't really develop the business practices or the business knowledge. One of the things that I think is different now is that these individuals live in commercial hubs in China and Southeast Asia. And as businessmen, they are learning a lot in terms of how to do business. And that's, I think, enhancing this kind of procurement capability in ways that we haven't seen before. But in terms of what we can do, you know, China certainly is a big part of it, but there are many different interest groups within China. And if you look at those groups on the Chinese side of the border with North Korea, they're making a pretty good livelihood from trade related to North Korea. And so I think from a Chinese national leadership perspective, this idea of cutting off all the trade, there would be some setbacks for domestic Chinese interests as well, which complicates the picture. But one important thing here to point out is that the Chinese don't really share the threat perception of particularly the United States. I think from the Chinese view, what North Korea is doing is trying to raise the stakes, get the attention of the United States, and essentially get back to the bargaining table. And for the Chinese, there has been this effort to encourage both the United States and North Korea to come back to the bargaining table. But that's the extent of what the Chinese view that they are willing to do, and frankly, what they're obligated to do. They don't see the North Korea nuclear issue as a problem that they somehow caused. And so they're very firm about that stance.
Hmm. That's interesting, because you would think everybody who lives in that part of the world would be very afraid of these developments. It could totally destabilize the whole region and kill a lot of people.
That certainly is the case for Japan and for South Korea. But there you also see differences. From the Japanese perspective, I think there's more in terms of the alignment of threat concerns related to North Korea, in terms of those threat concerns as they affect the United States as well. So the notion that Japan is a target for North Korean nuclear weapons as well as ballistic missiles. For South Korea, it's a bit different. Proximity, the capital of South Korea is very, very close to the border with North Korea. And there, the South Korean capital, and South Korea has a population of about 50 million, you're looking at almost half of the population living in the greater Seoul area, the capital of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And the decades-long threat emanating from North Korea have been the long-range artillery that are trained on the North Korean side on Seoul, the capital of South Korea. So you get to see how North Korea is viewed as a different type of threat by the different countries in the surrounding areas.
And what is the U.S. military presence?
In South Korea, you're looking at 28,500. In Japan, it's a larger presence. But when you look at the longstanding position of forward deployment in South Korea, it has been predominantly Army. But what I think is unique in terms of the current development is that there's been a greater tempo of operations and deployment of U.S. naval assets. Not too long ago, we actually had two U.S. aircraft carrier groups. These are the world's most powerful, most effective power projection capabilities simultaneously deployed near the Korean Peninsula. So to give you a sense of the urgency of the problem of having these capabilities ready if it did come to a serious situation. But the greater change in terms of the increase of deployment of U.S. naval assets.
And what does South Korea want us to do?
So South Korea is a country that is, if you think of the United States, is very extreme in terms of the political spectrum. I would argue South Korea is even more so. You have on one side the progressives that have long championed efforts to engage North Korea as a means to get to a long-term agreement that would resolve a number of issues, the nuclear issue as well as the fact that on the Korean Peninsula, the two Koreas are technically still at a state of war. When the Korean War fighting ceased in 1953, that was an armistice. So having a peace treaty, essentially putting it on a longer-term peace footing is a priority in many respects. The conservatives in South Korea have the view of North Korea as a direct threat, a military threat, and still, you know, bolstering self-defense capabilities, having closer alignment with the South Korean U.S. Military alliance structure are all priorities there. So you're looking at different approaches. Under the current progressive government, recently elected President Moon Jae-in, there is an effort to try to explore ways to engage North Korea, and we've seen these overtures to have negotiations or some sort of dialogue already.
Mm-hmm. And North Korea's relationship with South Korea?
So it really depends on who's in office in the presidential house in South Korea, which is called the Blue House. Usually there are contentious relations when there's a conservative president in the Blue House, and they're not always smooth, but there tends to be diplomatic breakthroughs when there is a progressive president in the Blue House. In the 2000s, there were two progressive presidents back-to-back, so we had about 10 years. South Korea has a 1 5-year term in terms of the presidency. We had two South Korean presidents then who essentially, the first one, Kim Dae-jung, rolled out what's called Sunshine Policy, and his successor, Noh Myo-eun, carried it on. But that was an effort to economically engage North Korea and come to this longer-term settlement of longstanding issues.
Mm-hmm. When you said that year, 1953, essentially they've been at war with each other since 1953.
That's
a heck of a long time, isn't it?
It is, and when you think about the peace treaty, that has been, I think, an area of a lot of, curiosity in terms of how you would actually resolve and sign. Who would be around the table to sign this peace treaty? What would the exact terms be? There are a lot of changes over the years, and the whole notion of would it be just between South Korea and North Korea, and then the United States and China as well. The North Koreans earlier on had a position where South Korea really shouldn't have a seat at the table. This was many years ago, and the view that it's really just the United States. So how that configuration happens is also part of the negotiation. But there have been a lot of calls for priority focus on the peace treaty as a way to almost break this deadlock in terms of relations on the Korean Peninsula. Hmm.
John, how many defectors have there been from North Korea?
I would estimate about over 30,000 North Korean defectors. And if you look at it from the outsider view, they're treated as a monolithic group, that they all came over because of food problems during the Great Famine or somewhere related around that time period. But there are actually almost three distinct groups now. The largest was from the period of food insecurity in the late 1990s, early 2000s. But we've had second and third generation of defectors. And the more recent ones, some of them have very specialized trading skills in these marketplaces. And so you get to see the evolution of North Korean society and the different internal dynamics in some instances by the types of defectors that come over and the different time periods there. But this is an important phenomenon in the sense that the 30,000 defectors in South Korea, we kind of see some aspects. If there is reunification on the Korean Peninsula in the medium or longer term, the whole notion of how the Koreans from the two previous sides of the Korean Peninsula, how they would coexist because they are so different. From a physical standpoint, the defectors from the earlier generation, because of the famine issues and things like that, you actually see physical stature being shorter and things along those lines. But they really do have societal differences that make this whole notion of what a Korean unified society will look like in the future.
Mm. And yet that sounds like a dream worth fighting for, doesn't it? A reunification.
So that's an interesting piece of the puzzle as well, because for South Korea, that's a generational type of interest. Mm-hmm. For the older generation, they actually do have family members who are still in North Korea. So the divided families issue is very much part of living history for them. But as they grow older and the possibility of being reunited even for these 2-3 day reunion periods organized by the Red Cross societies of both Koreas, as those become more remote, you're looking at the younger generations in South Korea that really are less interested in reunification, more of the focus of trying to sustainably deal with this security problem and this source of instability and get on with it in terms of economic development and, you know, jobs and the whole notion of the livelihood aspect of it. It's only relatively recently that South Korea joined the elite club of the $1 trillion economy, and so enjoying the fruits of the labor of previous generations, I think for a younger generation approach, they look at some of these estimates, and they're pretty staggering in some cases of how much South Korea society would have to shoulder by way of burdens on the financial side.
We welcome phone calls for our guests. We're talking about North Korea this hour of the program, and news broke earlier this morning that from CNN that U.S. intelligence indicates that North Korea is making preparations for another intercontinental ballistic missile or intermediate range missile test. Our guests have indicated that that could be a missile that would go even farther than Anchorage, Alaska, which ups the ante here. What in the world is to be done about all of this? What is the United States to do right now to keep the North Koreans from developing more nuclear weapons? Is it unheard of, an impossibility, to begin some kind of negotiation that would mean that they would get rid of their nuclear weapons and maybe we would get rid of a military presence along the DMZ and in Japan? Or does that seem just like a pipe dream? But the threat is pretty frightening. So maybe decades, as our guests have said, of deciding to do nothing have caught up with this. And what do we do now? What do you think? What do we do now? Our phone number, lines are open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you'd like, talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, phone calls coming in steady now. Elaine in Colfax, hi.
Hi. I wondered if your guest could comment on Dennis Rodman visiting North Korea. He's a former NBA player. He's quite flamboyant and interesting character. And he went, I think this last time, he was funded by some Marijuana Growers Association, which, you know, a lot of people laugh at, ha-ha, you know. But I think there's some serious intent Dennis Rodman is an interesting character who, when he was in Iowa living with a family, he got a child to talk that hadn't talked in years, who had accidentally killed his brother in an accident. And, I mean, I imagine he's actually doing something there, or am I wrong?
So, Elaine, the story of Dennis Rodman and his involvement with North Korea is very complex, in the sense that certainly there have been stated efforts to use what has traditionally been viewed as sports diplomacy. In a previous trip, he brought together a collection of NBA players, and they played against the North Korean national basketball team, and they also did different permutations of this type of sports diplomacy. But when you kind of piece together, one trend that does emerge is a monetary benefit for Dennis Rodman. In the most recent trip, he was sponsored by a Montreal-based outfit called Potcoin. And so they're using Bitcoin type of currency to try to finance the sale of marijuana. So basically a business opportunity there. The other efforts to interact with Kim Jong-un, there in a previous trip, this is when Dennis Rodman's drinking was pretty out of hand. That was a period where there was an opportunity to meet and spend time with Kim Jong-un at one of the ski resorts that he had developed and talk about other types of cooperation and whatnot. But because of the erratic behavior and the drinking of Dennis Rodman at that time, Kim Jong-un decided not to show up. So you're kind of seeing a very interesting interaction. The final thing I would mention here is there is the argument that irrespective of this type of erratic behavior, the fact is Dennis Rodman is the only American to have met Kim Jong-un.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, things that we know about the Kim Jong-un regime are because of Dennis Rodman. We do know that Kim Jong-un and his wife, Lee Soo-ju, have a daughter named Kim Ju-ae because, Dennis Rodman had that kind of access to the family. These are pieces of information of the family that, as you can imagine, for those who are interested in trying to piece together the dynamics there, this is an important source. But there are all the question marks about credibility related to Dennis Rodman.
Thanks, Elaine, for the call. Bill in Spooner. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking at a little recent history of Gaddafi in Libya and Saddam in Iraq, mm-hmm. who brokered away nuclear ambitions for various, inducements from the United States. And that didn't turn out well for them. How much does that play into the current North Korean leader and his cronies of how they look at brokering nuclear arms away or this sanction or that sanction for leaving?
All right. And let me throw Iran into the mix, too, because they were persuaded to surrender components of their nuclear program.
Sure. Bill, to your point there, that's something the North Korean officials have stated in a number of official and unofficial interactions with the American side. This point that had Gaddafi or Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons, both of those leaders would still be in power. So it's a powerful perception that the North Korean regime retains, and it gives a sense of how they put a lot of emphasis on developing their own nuclear weapons capability for the survival of the leader and the regime and so forth. But the piece of Iran is interesting in the sense that certainly we do have the Iran deal, and that was an effort with multilateral partners and a lot of coordination. Eventually they came to the agreement, and sanctions had a big part to play in getting the Iranian side to the table. But one of the differences, though, with North Korea, core one, is that the Iran's program is at an early stage, and if you look at it, this is where some of the analogies start to look more and more like apples and oranges. Because of the North Korean advances in both their ICBM capability as well as their nuclear weapons testing, that, I think, gives a sense for the North Koreans that they want to be treated differently from an Iran. And that becomes an area where efforts to try to engage North Korea with what's called the Iran playbook fall short from the North Korean perspective.
I'm trying to remember, wasn't there a time... was it during the Nixon administration when the North Koreans shot down a U.S. military plane and a number of servicemen died? And was it Nixon who decided to do nothing? We've decided to do nothing for a long time. Why didn't we do something way back then?
So the big incident, the famous one, is the capture of the USS Puebla, which was a U.S. Navy surveillance vessel, and the detainment of the crew for over a year
right.
in North Korea. And that led to a situation where it could have been the brink of war. But if you recall the context with Vietnam and the quagmire in Vietnam, I think the ability to try to do something there and the possibility of it flaring up led to, I think, more limited options at that particular point in time. But it's a very remarkable story, and if you look at it, the North Koreans still have the USS Pueblo. It's a museum part on the Taedong River, so it gives a sense of the legacy of that particular episode.
And we go next to Jerry in Waukesha. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that if people are interested in Korea and they don't know that much about it, they read a book by Max Hastings written back in the 80s. It's called The Korean War, and it's a good overview of the whole thing, and Max Hastings always does a great job on defining the problems that are associated with these wars that we get ourselves into, and in particular, how bad it was in Korea at the time. So that's just my recommendation.
Thank you, John. I'm sure you know that book.
Thank you, and it's an excellent book. And the other one I would also recommend is The Two Koreas by Don Oberdorfer and updated versions, editions with Bob Carlin. But that gives, I think, a great perspective of the two Koreas and the surrounding countries and their intertwined histories over the decades as well.
Thanks, Jerry. And Jack in Wisconsin Rapids, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm curious to know who's actually propping this Kim Jong-un up. I mean, I would think that he's just a young guy, and there must be generals and other people that are propping him up. And if there's any chance that there's someone in his administration that would maybe turn on him and start a coup d'etat, I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jack.
Yeah, the story of the North Korean regime and how it runs is a fascinating one. What we've been able to piece together, and by no means is it a complete picture, but through the defectors that have specialized experiences and other analysts from different countries. First off, Kim Jong-il has this reputation of being an iron-fisted ruler, but one thing that emerges is that he ran the country in a way that he gave lucrative concessions related to the mining sector or other parts of the economy to powerful generals, and that was a way to get that kind of support and loyalty. One of the interesting things for Kim Jong-un is that he's replaced all of his father's generals and installed his own generals and stripped those lucrative commercial concessions away from his father's generals and given it to his generals. So you get to see this symbiotic relationship where for the sustained prosperity of those elites, you get to see how they all have to get along and coordinate. But to your point about potential internal revolt or something like that, a rogue general or another leader, one of the things that's unique about North Korea is that there are a set of three internal security organizations whose sole purpose is to protect the Kim regime, the Kim family. And these security organizations spy on the people, the 99%, spy on the 1%, spy on the military, and spy on each other.
Wow.
So it becomes very difficult to do this type of organizing and trying to create some kind of faction or movement. And in terms of what we know about resource allocation, certainly the nuclear weapons program gets very priority status. But I would argue that the top priority is resourcing these three security organizations.
To the tune of how much, do you think?
I think it's something that it's hard to estimate, but to give you a fact in terms of the standards and the well-being and prosperity of those in the security forces, they're far better than in the military. So for a country that is lauded as military first, for the 1.3 million man army, there are documented cases of malnutrition and TB, whereas for the internal security organization, they're better equipped with weapons and they're taken better care of. So from that very visible distinction, you get to see where the priorities lay.
Yeah. Thank you, John, very much. Very knowledgeable.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you, Kathleen.
John Park, director of the Korea Working Group. He's an adjunct lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School and faculty affiliate with the project on managing the atom at the Harvard Kennedy School's Center for Science and International Affairs. And we thank Melissa Hannum, Senior Research Associate in the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey's East Asian Nonproliferation Program. Thanks to Colleen Leahy for producing this program and to Gretchen Brown for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee.